This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. And here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Public schooling has collapsed. Public health care continue to fail the poor and the vulnerable. What were we expecting?
That's Free State University Chancellor Bonang Mohail in South Africa on the riots currently going on. Details coming up. Also, the Islamic State is gaining allies in Africa. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In South Africa, civil society groups, citizens, and opposition parties have condemned their government's response to the ongoing violence in the country. What began as protests against the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma for refusing to answer questions at the Commission of Inquiry into Corruption is now mass civil unrest. Soldiers and police have been unable to stop large crowds of people from looting and destroying property. More than 70 people have been killed and hundreds injured, and the economy has lost billions of dollars. Darren Taylor reports.
From the police helicopter hovering above, it looks like a normal, everyday rush hour traffic jam on a highway on the outskirts of the port city of Durban. But the long lines of vehicles below are driven by people waiting for their turn to loot warehouses of home appliances, food, and other goods. One of the buildings is on fire, but still the looters stream in. Many South Africans are intensely disappointed and angry at the government's inability to stop the rioting and looting. Leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, is visiting Durban to assess the situation there.
It is really quite terrifying to see the absolute devastation, the complete destruction, but also the despair of many, many of the communities here who feel completely abandoned by the security services and who have been left to fend for themselves. Buildings have been burnt down. Bodies are literally strewn, lying in the road. This is clearly a situation that is not under control. It's not getting any better.
Free State University Chancellor Bonang Mohail agrees.
It is heartbreaking to see people strolling casually with empty trolleys. When they come back, trolleys the size of a triple-story house, and they take it to cars that are parked as if this is a normal Sunday afternoon shopping. People carrying refrigerators on their heads, an entire cow on their shoulders, flat screens everywhere.
Mohail says the country's paying now for the ruling African National Congress's continued protection of corrupt and incompetent leaders.
Everywhere for the last 15 years, at least, we are seeing black graduates roaming the streets absolutely hopelessly. Inequality has actually widened. Racism is at an all-time high. Public schooling has collapsed. Public health care continue to fail the poor and the vulnerable. What were we expecting when this ANC-led government...
Wits University governance expert Judith February says citizens don't trust the police service they see as brutal and corrupt. This has been reinforced by images of police officers joining the looting. Given that, says February, and also because citizens believe political leaders have stolen from the state for 20 years, the current anarchy makes total sense.
This is a country which is steeped in impunity. Our roots are in impunity. Our roots are also deeply in violence. If you look at any of the local government research, I mean, what people tell you is they only come when we start to burn things. The participatory democracy that the Constitution envisages and talks about, that's largely been broken by corruption, by an inability of the state to actually deliver to people.
Over the past few days, the state has deployed the army in Johannesburg, but there are no soldiers visible at places that continue to be attacked and pillaged in Durban and the nearby city of Pietermaritzburg. Security officials told VOA this is because they've received intelligence that mobs are now planning to attack key installations such as harbors and airports, and so the army's guarding these. Stiernaesen says this is good, but not good enough.
My real fear is that if we don't contain the situation here in KwaZulu-Natal, this is going to spread like wildfire around the rest of the country.
This is already unfolding, with looting and corresponding destruction now happening in cities and towns in several regions. The violence has halted South Africa's COVID-19 vaccination rollout and is now causing food and fuel shortages. In many areas, people can't get cash because banks and ATMs are closed. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Islamic State terrorist organization is gaining allies in Africa. Extremist groups linked to both the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are intensifying their grip on communities across large parts of the African continent. Some facts on the ground are contributing to African insurgency groups joining the violent Islamic State organization. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Emily Estelle, research manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project.
There are a couple of attractions for more local jihadist groups looking to join up to international groups. In some cases, it's an issue of branding initially and distinguishing themselves. So, for example, looking at West Africa, the Islamic State group in the Sahel had already existed as a splinter group before it joined up to the Islamic State. There are other reasons. The religious motivation is part of it for groups that already subscribe to this ideology. The Islamic State's formation of the caliphate was significant. There are also concrete benefits like training, money, recruiting foreign fighters, access to propaganda tools. All of those things are concrete benefits that these groups may be seeking when they pledge to the Islamic State or to Al-Qaeda.
Where is the most serious threat of the Islamic State in Africa, and what facts on the ground helped the terrorist organization to penetrate African countries?
I'd argue that the most serious Islamic State threat in Africa now is in West Africa, actually. Looking at the Islamic State's West Africa province in Nigeria, which is the group's largest province in Africa, and recently has gotten larger by gaining some of the support from Boko Haram, which is another group that also exists there. The reasons that that group and others exist comes back to several different facts on the ground. The existence of popular political grievances and conflict sets the conditions for Salafi jihadi groups to embed themselves in the conditions or gain local support. So it may be that there's actual conflict going on and that a jihadist group can either align itself with other local groups towards a common objective or position themselves as defenders of a vulnerable group. Say, you know, they'll protect a group of people as long as those people follow all of their rules, and the local populations often don't have really any alternative. Sometimes these jihadist groups also fill a local need. So let's say there's a lack of a court or a dispute resolution mechanism. You know, any court therefore can provide a service. So even if the rulings are bad, they may be valuable. So in the case of jihadist groups, they come in and set up a court, they can embed themselves in a local context.
So what changes most when African insurgent groups become affiliates of the Islamic State in the African continent?
So here I'll borrow from the research of Dr. Jason Warner at West Point, and he has written about groups that join the Islamic State becoming norm adopters, where their self-conception changes to a degree and they change the patterns of violence they engage in and how they interact with local societies. In a lot of cases, what you'll see when a group kind of becomes part of the Islamic State is either immediately before or immediately after that pledge, you'll see an uptick in brutality or in certain types of attacks, as well as changes in their propaganda. One exception that somewhat proves the rule is actually in Nigeria, where the Islamic State group presented itself as relatively more moderate than Boko Haram and actually focused, you know, more of its energy on attacking security forces rather than civilians. That's actually consistent with the larger trend in that both the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have kind of larger sets of norms and ways that they channel their violence. And groups coming in line with those larger norms is part of the process of pledging and becoming an affiliate.
That was Emily Estelle with the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shinawi. A second Southern Africa Development Community SADC delegation has arrived in Eswatini on a fact-finding mission following weeks of civil unrest. But pro-democracy activists say they are unaware of the visit, accusing the regional bloc of bias in the mediation efforts. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
The delegation from Botswana, South Africa and Zimbabwe arrives in Eswatini today and follows last week's visit to Eswatini by the SADC Council of Ministers. Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi, who chairs the SADC organ on politics, security and defense, asked the second delegation to return to Eswatini. He said Tuesday there are concerns the initial trip only collected information from government officials, leaving out the voices of pro-democracy protesters.
A second mission comprising technocrats from the three countries will leave for Eswatini tomorrow to engage all stakeholders and report back to the ministerial committee of the organ.
But like Lukele, the spokesperson for a coalition of civic organizations in Eswatini, Swaziland Solidarity Network, SSN, says the grouping is unaware of the visit.
Well, these are news to us. As the Swaziland Solidarity Network, together with the progressive forces in Swaziland, that SADC is coming. They have not communicated with anyone. So if SADC, for instance, is sincere and honest about any meaningful fact-finding mission or dialogue, they must just give enough time to the very same organizations, the civil society, inform them formally and clearly state the agenda.
Lukele says the mission would be incomplete if the victims of the crackdown on protesters are not consulted.
They must prepare to go and meet the victims of this shooting. So we are appealing to President Masisi that his conscience speaks to him. We are appealing to his conscience to speak to him and find a way and communicate with the civil society because he knows where they are.
The SADC visit comes as another demonstration is planned for Friday. King Mswati III will reportedly address the nation during a cultural ceremony on the same day. Civil unrest has rocked the tiny kingdom for several weeks, with protesters demanding reforms, including an end to bans on political parties. More than 20 people have died as security forces cracked down on the protests. King Mswati III has ruled Africa's remaining absolute monarch for more than three decades. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
The Zimbabwe government will become the first nation to exempt all SADC member states from visa requirements in its bid to facilitate the African Continental Free Trade Area. Arigando gives us more on the reaction to the development.
Citizens of the Southern African Development Community nations no longer will need visas to enter Zimbabwe. The Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Frederick Shaba, recently said the measure is intended to boost trade and tourism and the movement of citizens within the region, in line with Zimbabwe's ratification of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Zimbabwe is also part of CASA Univisa, which is available to 65 nations and allows visitors to Zimbabwe and Zambia unlimited access to the two countries for 30 days. Many economic analysts see the move as largely positive. Mambo Hamaindu from Zambia says the measure is in line with the goal of greater African integration.
It's a positive development that Zimbabwe has taken, and one can only hope that other countries within the SADC region will also follow suit or will reciprocate with visas. It was a bit expensive to move from one country to another. If all countries within the region follow suit, we would have more people moving cross borders, interacting. How can you have a free trade area and then you also have restrictions on or you also have visa requirements which inhibit travel?
Some economists think Zimbabwe is hoping to gain an advantage by being the first. Oswald Bina sees calculation behind the move, since the AFCTA trade policies focused on technical issues around custom procedures, rules of origin, transit procedures, and trade facilitation. location.
Remember, outside COVID, Zimbabwe boasts of a very unique tourism product, a product that compares very well globally. When you look at what we do have as a country, it is important that we start to lead the way in terms of the free movement of people.
Economic analyst Bechani Chereni from Malawi welcomes the move and says it will help trade among the Southern African nations.
It is very important that the barriers to trade must be removed. Some of these barriers to trade have been the movement of goods, the movement of people as well. Certainly, visa requirements have been unnecessary, really. You know, you go to a border post or an airport, you stay so long there. And we say bravo to Zimbabwe for such a very, very important move. It's a brave move, by the way.
Analyst Thomas Stolle sees the decision as benefiting Zimbabwe the most, but the global pandemic may stall progress.
It's in the sense that the movement of goods and people is going to be smooth. The COVID situation is going to obviously affect the movement of goods and services, because as we see the increase in cases in the region, South Africa being the epicenter, and the lockdown measures that are put in place obviously will make it a point that movement becomes very difficult. And much as we open up our borders,
the African Continental Free Trade Agreement went into effect on January 1st this year. It aims to increase trade and boost economic development among the 55 signatory nations on the continent by reducing tariffs and easing regulatory trade barriers. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The International Organization for Migration said Wednesday deaths along maritime migration routes to Europe have more than doubled in the first half of this year compared with the same period in 2020. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is concerned with the increase in deaths on maritime migration routes to Europe. The organization said Wednesday that at least 1,146 people died attempting to reach Europe in the first 6 months of 2021, adding that the number has more than doubled compared to the same period last year. Most of those who died trying to reach Europe were attempting to cross the Mediterranean. The total number of attempted crossings is also on the rise. More than 31,500 people were intercepted or rescued by North African authorities in the first half of 2021, compared to just over 23,000 in the same period last year. Many of the migrants departed from Tunisia, headed for Italy. Italy is very concerned about the increasing arrivals, as Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese explained in an interview with Italian national television. Lamorgese said that in July the arrivals from Tunisia have multiplied due to that country's deep economic crisis. They are economic migrants that cannot stay in Italy, and so they will be repatriated, likely from early August. She added that areas have been identified where the migrants can be tested and placed in quarantine, including a large ship. Lamorgese said repatriations will increase.
L'Italia sta sopportando davvero tanto le conseguenze.
She said Italy is taking a huge brunt of the crisis in Tunisia, and seeing as these are economic migrants, it is right that they should return home. The IOM data shows that deaths occurred because of insufficient search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean and on the Atlantic route to the Canary Islands, even though interceptions off the North African coast have increased for the second consecutive year. IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino called on countries to take urgent measures to prevent loss of life. He said increasing search and rescue efforts and ensuring access to safe and legal migration pathways are key steps towards achieving this goal. The IOM also said over 15,300 people were returned to Libya in the first 6 months of 2021, almost three times higher than the same period last year. But this is also a concern, it said, given that migrants who are returned to Libya are subjected to arbitrary detention, extortion, disappearances, and torture. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The arrival of the refugee Olympic team to compete in the Tokyo Games has been delayed because one team official has tested positive for COVID-19. About 26 out of 29 refugee team members are currently in a training camp in Qatar and will remain there along with 10 of the 11 officials. The International Olympic Committee, IOC, today said the infected official has been quarantined and is without symptoms. The refugee team, which will compete under the Olympic flag, includes athletes from Syria, South Sudan, Eritrea, Afghanistan, and Iran. The team is almost three times as big as the inaugural refugee team at the Rio de Janeiro 2016 Olympics, with 29 athletes competing in 12 sports. The odds were against Adiyu Achul. Her family members were killed in present-day South Sudan when she was a child, and she grew up in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp. Achul worked hard to become an entrepreneur and activist, and she now collects donations for residents of the camp. Juma Majanga has her story from Nairobi.
Adiyu Achul is making soap at her home-based factory in the suburbs east of Nairobi. Her name means a crying bird in the Dinka dialect, and she tells a horrifying story of her childhood, even as she covers it with an infectious smile. The hardship of growing up in a refugee camp made Achul want to do something to change the plight of refugees. And after getting trained in soap making, she set up a business.
I believe I'm still a refugee, and anything I do will always help my community. I'm in a position to be able to help my community. Why will I not help them?
Achul works with humanitarian groups like the UN Refugee Agency to distribute soap, face masks, food, and other donated items to the most vulnerable and needy families among refugees. She also hosts communities back at the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps. Eugene Bian is the UNHCR Kenya spokesperson.
The refugee who approach us with a brilliant idea like Adieu had, that they want to help a refugee and also the vulnerable host community, then we must support, because the funding for the humanitarian agency unfortunately reducing significantly during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Having overcome many odds, Achul is completing her last year of studies for a Bachelor of Commerce degree. Her first day on campus felt like being in heaven, she tells a VOA reporter. Achul had never before stepped out of the Dadaab refugee camp since entering it as a child. The marvel of the city was like a new world to her. She was frightened of elevators and didn't know how to climb stairs. Today, she runs a mentorship program for refugee girls and young women.
I run two mentorship programs, one just to train them on basic entrepreneurial skill. And then the second one is about the important and mobilization, anything to do with education specifically. So that when after their childbirth, they will choose either to go back to school or to have their own business.
Kenya is one of Africa's top refugee hosting countries, with over 500,000 refugees, mainly from the neighboring Somalia and South Sudan. But the government wants to close two camps, which together house more than 400,000 refugees and asylum seekers. Achul is worried about the fate of refugees if the camps close, saying many refugees know only the camps at their home and will have nowhere else to go. The UNHCR's Bian says she is urging Kenya to keep them open.
We're living in the period that more than 80 million people are displaced over the world. And this is a time that we need a solidarity more than ever.
While the refugees await Kenya's final decision, former refugees like Achul are stepping forward to help the vulnerable in their community during a difficult and uncertain time. Juma, Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Iyabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.